Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I don't think we have a lady present, actually. I'm not going to waste time in introducing Mr. Cox. All I'm going to tell you is that he's been in the aircraft industry for some 43 years, and he was on Mitchell's team. Since then, he's worked in other places, but he has spent a lot of time and care in getting together the facts and verifying them regarding the Schneider Trophy. I think those of you who are here are aware how important the Schneider Trophy was to us in this country, because it was followed up by the Spitfire and improvements in other aircraft that were valuable in the Second World War. So I'll ask that more ado. I'll ask Mr. Cox, as a member of the Society, to give his lecture on the Schneider Trophy. Mr. Cox.
Schneider, gentlemen. Although there were several interim reports on the Schneider Trophy while the series was in progress, I think this is the first occasion that the full story has been told here. And tonight I would like to try and convey the skill and the enthusiasm and sacrifice that all the participants had to endure and the rightful place they were taken in the annals of aviation history. The Schneider International Seaplane Trophy Contest originated through a Frenchman of that name, Monsieur Gates Schneider, who was the son of the founder of the Schneider Armament factory in France, and he himself was a pioneer of aviation. And his reasons for denoting the trophy were no doubt due to the following facts: that the first seaplane flight occurred in May 1910, and by 1912 the first international seaplane meeting was held at Monaco, which ended with most of the machines being wrecked. The obvious lesson being that seaplane design was a specialized subject and some incentive was required to encourage designers to overcome the initial problems if the seaplane was to advance in the same way as the land plane was doing. But this incentive was forthcoming at the end of 1912, when it was announced that Monsieur Schneider would offer to the Aero Club of France a trophy for international competition according to rules and regulations laid down by the Fédération Aéronautique Internationale, and was open to all types of marine aircraft. The object of the contest was not a pure speed event. It was done to develop the seaplane as a commercial transport vehicle, and to this end, several seaworthiness and navigability trials were laid down in the rules. It accumulated in a 150-mile course flown over the open sea, just a speed trial. These trials remained until the end of the contest, but as the speed trial became the more important feature, so the trials were modified and at the end became comparatively simple take-off and landing tests with a full load. I should say at this stage, of course, that at the time it was never contemplated that it would become a contest between governments. Before presenting the history of the contest itself, there are one or two facts that I should go over just to put you in the picture. There were 12 contests in all, and they took place between 1913 and 1931. From 1915 until 1918, the contests were suspended due to the First World War, and there was no contest in 1924 due to lack of challenges. And from 1927 onwards, the contest was held every other year. The trophy racing machines began and ended as wire-braced monoplanes. that there was an intermediate period when biplanes and flying boats competed successfully. The 12 contests attracted over 120 entries, but only 50 of these appeared on the starting line. And of those 50, only 24 succeeded in completing the course. A good indication of the grueling nature of the speed course. Great Britain sent 14 starters, 10 completing the course, and these provided 5 winners, 2 second places, and 2 third places. 3 of their machines retired because of fog. Seemed a bit unusual, but I shall tell you more about that. One machine was disqualified, and only one machine retired with mechanical trouble, which was an amazing tribute to British engines. In fact, of course, this reliability, coupled with the increased horsepower over the contest, was the deciding factor in the winning of the trophy. The team from each country was limited to 3 and was always entered by the aero club of the country concerned. Now, just to conclude that introduction, there are 3 slides, so could I have the first one, please? This is a good old slide, it's done yeoman duty. It shows the overall speed record up to the early 60s. But the point I want to emphasise is where you can see the silhouette of the seaplane. That is when the seaplane took over from the land plane as the major speed vehicle. I think I'd better have the next slide now. I've actually increased the scale of that particular one to show how the seaplane overtook the aeroplane as the fastest vehicle. And the top point of the graph of the seaplane represents the speed attained by the Marquis Castaldi 72, which, in my opinion, was the ultimate in propeller-driven seaplanes. It attained a speed of 440 miles an hour. The third slide now, please. This is the speed against horsepower. You'll notice that it's fairly steady until 1929, and then there was this amazing jump of 1,000 horsepower, which was supplied, of course, by the Rolls-Royce R engine. And this was undoubtedly the vital factor in the winning of the trophy. Both the Italians and the Americans tried to make an engine of that caliber, but they never succeeded in getting the life or reliability required for the short duration of the contest. Well, I think that's completely introduction. I can now get on to the contest proper. The first contest was arranged by the Aero Club of France, and Monaco was the venue. The contest was only an item in a large program of what was called a hydro aeroplane meeting. The word seaplane hadn't been coined then. It was held at Monaco in April. Only France and America were competing. France sending 3 starters and America 1. The course was about 150 miles of 28 laps of 6.2 miles, rather short laps. Only 2 machines completed the course. The winner was a Frenchman, Marcel Prévost, flying the old Depot Doucin seat monoplane, which was fitted with a 160 horsepower Gnome engine. But his performance had that comic touch that nearly all these early aeroplane meetings had. He did not fly over the finishing line as required by rule, and he had to go out to finish the last lap again. This took nearly an hour of his official time and brought his average speed down to 45.75 miles an hour, just above his story. The other French entry was Roland Garros, who was flying the little Morane Saulnier monoplane, and he only averaged 32.6 miles an hour. This was due to the fact that he had several engine failures and he had to refuel at least twice. But the starting time was 8 o'clock in the morning and the finish was at sunset, so they had plenty of time to sort of lock over the course. The second contest, France's winners were hosts and they chose Monaco again as the venue. And there was a good entry the second contest, Great Britain, USA, France, and Switzerland, and Germany. The German entry was eliminated during the navigability trials, which only left the British, French, and USA, and the Swiss. Two French machines were the first to take off, followed by Harold Pixton in the Southwest Tabloid. The Swiss entry was next, piloted by Monsieur Bury on a Franco-British flying boat. That's an actual picture of the contest underway, and shows Pixton overtaking the Franco-British flying boat. Pixton averaged 86.82 miles an hour, and this speed surprised the French so much that the rest of them never started, and Pixton was declared the winner. It was a great surprise, this, to the French. They were always champions of the monoplane, and this was a direct answer on behalf of the biplane enthusiasts, and from then onwards, the biplane gradually crept into favour. This is the picture of the tabloid. The interesting thing about this machine was that it was designed with a single central float, but on its first tryout, it capsized. So when the tide went out, the machine was hauled ashore, taken back to Kingston. They sawed this single float in halves and filled the ends up and mounted it as you see it. It was then packed up and sent to Monaco, and I think the actual contest was its second float. It might have been the third. I can't quite verify this spot, but it certainly wasn't later than the third. Both the Sopwith and the Depardieu Sam both used wing warping instead of ailerons. Of course, the First World War intervened immediately after this, but you could see which way the Schneider Trophy was going, because, of course, from the tabloid came the Camel, all the famous Sopwith single-seater fighters, and the Depardieu Sam was taken up by the Spad organization, who also produced fighters. So even at that time, you could see how the race was going to develop. The 1914 victory left Britain as hosts when the war ended, and they were charged with organising the next contest, which was held in 1919 at Bournemouth, the start and finishing line, of course, being the pierhead. Seven entries, three representing Great Britain, three from France, and one from Italy. But there were the usual non-arrivals and accidents. But the slides I have got are worth showing. This is the Spad Herbimont French entry. And I'm not quite sure, but I'm unable to confirm it, actually, that this machine lost its propeller when they were lowering it there in the beach. They had no slipway, and the propeller struck a wave, of course, and it disintegrated. But I included it because it's not a streamlined machine, but it is fair. It's quite a good effort for those particular days. And you'll notice that the rudder has got the old Spad wire trailing edge. When I say it's a good effort, when you see the next slide, you'll see what I mean. This is the Italian Savoia 13. This was the only machine to complete the 10 laps. Nothing spectacular about it, except, of course, that it's got a fully swept bit of rubber. Nothing new under the sun. The next slide, please. This is the Supermarine Sea Lion. Again, a built-in headwind. It's got quite a modern characteristic, of course, that the tailplane is a downward lifting one in the same way as part of our modern jets. But the most interesting thing with this machine was the procedure for takeoff. As I mentioned, there were no slipways, and the mechanic had to stand on the wing to crank the engine. When the engine was running sweetly, he dived overboard and swam for it. Apparently, it was a good thing for grand engineers to carry a swimming certificate besides the usual A, B, or C license. The day of the speed contest proved very disappointing. Fog patches covered the bay, and not until late in the afternoon was there any chance of it clearing. Anyhow, the pilots themselves took charge, and the three British entries took off, and soon returned to say that it was impossible to continue the fog was too thick. But the Italian, Ginello, had taken off and was apparently lapping quite consistently, but at a speed greater than the machine was capable of. What had happened was that the yacht had moored some miles short of the Swanage turning point, and the fog had not closed on it. But with amazing flying instinct, Ginello had been able to pick it up for 10 laps. This was confirmed when the crew from the correct marker boat came in and said, well, yes, we'd heard plenty of machines, but we never saw any. So, of course, the home race was declared null and void. The conditions had been met. But as a compliment to the Italians' efforts, they decided to hold the next contest in Italy. The fourth contest then was held at Venice, and this again was in the nature of a fiasco. There were no foreign challengers, and this was due to financial difficulties in Italy, and they were only represented by one aircraft, a Savoia 19. And the first attempt to complete the course ended in bad weather, and not until 2 days later was the weather fine enough for the rest of the lap to be completed. And the average speed was only 107 miles an hour, so again, it was a very disappointing result. The fifth contest in 1921 was again held in Venice with almost the same result, although the Italians did put three machines into it. Only one completed the course, one retired due to lack of fuel, and the other one caught fire. So there was not much in those contests. In 1922, the prospects appeared to be much better because there were two French entries and a British entry. But unfortunately, one French entry wasn't completed in time and the other was disqualified in the navigability trials. So this left one challenger, a Great Britain. This was the Supermarine Sea Lion. This year, or that particular, I should say, was held at Naples, and the Sea Lion was the first machine away and completed the first lap at 150 miles an hour, which frightened the Italians somewhat. But of course, they couldn't keep this up and had to reduce his speed. But Henry Biard, the Supermarine test pilot, flew a very cleverly judged race and beat the Italians by 1.5 minutes. And that was the machine. It's the only authentic picture I could find of that particular machine. You'll find plenty of machines that might have been it. When I say that the hull at that time was about 6 years old, and it started life with a 32-foot span, and on that occasion it was down to about 22 feet, you'll see why there's a lot of pictures, but not many of the authentic ones. This surprise victory was all the more noteworthy in that it was a private venture and due to the individual enterprise of Mr. Hubert Scott Payne and Mr. H.T. Vane of the Supermarine and Napier firms, respectively. It also brought to public notice for the first time the designer, a young man named Reginald J. Mitchell, who was to become famous for his Schneider Trophy work and other famous aircraft, including, of course, the Spitfire. This jump of 38 miles an hour in the average speed indicated a change in tempo, and it was a case of coming events casting their shadows before. For the next contest to be held in England was to alter the concept of the whole contest, and from a rather casual affair, as you'll gather I've described so far, it turned into a main international competition between governments and brought the seaplane to the forefront of aeronautical development at the time. I should like to mention here that at that time, the United States and the British government were really becoming interested in high-speed research. And the two approaches are worth noting. The British government guaranteed to buy any aircraft of British design and manufacture that won an international or similar class trophy. and they would loan it for further development if required. Now, the Americans, they had special aircraft designed and built with full technical and financial help, and most important of all, the pilots were service trained. In fact, although not officially recognized or understood at the time, the high-speed flight had arrived. So, with this background, we go on to the 1923 contest. As a result of the British win in Italy, the seventh contest was held at Kays in September and attracted an excellent number of entries. For the first time, a government-sponsored team of three aircraft was entered by the United States Navy as the principal challengers to Britain, who also entered a full team. France entered three machines, and Italy two. Unfortunately, there were a number of accidents and non-arrivals again, and the lineup at the start was as follows. Great Britain was to be represented by the Sea Lion. The same machine in slightly different disguise. The Napier Lion had been paired off with a rather crude nacelle. The usual approach in those days was to cut 2 feet off the wingtip, increase the landing speed, and of course at the same time the top speed, and that's what was done with that machine. The launching trolley, of course, was taken off before flight. The next machine was the United States Navy. They had two of the famous Curtiss CR-3 machines, piloted by Lieutenant Irving of the United States Navy and Lieutenant Rittenhouse of the United States Navy. And this is the famous Curtiss CR-3, the machine that really shook all Europeans. It was powered with a Curtiss V12 engine, and as you can see, very small overall dimensions. This was the first machine that Europe saw using wing radiators, the all-metal propeller, and as I've mentioned before, the very clean little fuselage. And the two Curtiss machines took off in formation those days, and their first lap speeds indicated that unless there was any engine failure, the race was a foregone conclusion. Well, the two D-12s behaved very well, and they flew into first and second phases. The winning speed was 177 miles an hour, again a big jump, and the Sea Lion had to be content with third place at 151. This was the most important contest so far. For entirely new features appeared in this contest. First, the officially sponsored entry of the United States Navy, which put it onto the government level, and the employment of the best technical and financial sources available to make sure it was a winning effort. But most of it, important of all, as I mentioned before, was the use of service pilots to fly the machine. It meant that in future contests, the days of private endeavour were over, and from then onwards, every contest had to be backed by full financial and technical resources. Now, this is an appropriate time to introduce another designer who was to become famous for his work in the Schneider Trophy. I'm speaking of the late H.B. Holland, who at that time was definitely was the only designer of high-speed aircraft in the country. And his machine for that year was the famous Gloucester Bammel II, which in the aerial derby had averaged 196 miles an hour. That's with a land plane chassis. So if it had been used in the contest with a float chassis, it might have beaten the Americans, or at least it would have kept them to heel. But it wasn't used, so that's that. Could I have the next slide, please? That shows it. A rather almost of the senior publishing photographs of them. Nothing spectacular, just a quote from it. The United States, having won the 23 contest, of course, were responsible for organizing 1924 contest. And as a result of the mammals' performance on land, the Air Ministry asked for one to be fitted with floats, and the Gloucester 2 was officially entered by Great Britain as the in the 1924 contest. Unfortunately, while the machine was undergoing trials at Felixstowe, the chassis collapsed and the machine sank, so we were forced to withdraw. The Italians, too, had had some trouble, and they withdrew, and it meant that there were no competitors to the United States, who very sportingly declared the contest off until the next year, rather than fly over the course with no competitors. This was an endeavor to keep the contest alive. But in doing so, they denied themselves the chance of winning the trophy outright. The 1925 contest brought the first European reactions to the CR3s. The European designers had realized that with the high landing speed of the seaplane, we'd consequently get a higher top speed. And they rethought and produced some wonderful examples in this particular contest. It was held at Baltimore in October. They had to ask for a little bit of time to finish the machines off. This again was the happy relations that existed between countries at that time. This was Holland's 1925 entry. It was known as the Gloucester 3. It's only a cleaned-up version of the battle, in a sense. You'll notice there are the big radiators, Lamlin radiators, on the leading edge of the wing, but the wires around the fin and rudder, and the plates, which were of all metal, were supplied by short rudders. The rest of the machine, of course, was wood. Now, this was Mitchell's reaction to the CR3. He took one look at them and he realized that at the CR3s, and he realized that the flying boat was out as a speed vehicle, and this was what he produced, the S4, a full cantilever monoplane wing. There were no bracing wires whatsoever, and apart from the wing radiators, those were the only extrudences on the machine. Again, all wooden construction, except of course for the float struts that were steel tubed, and wooden floats. Before this machine went to America, it established a new seaplane record of 226 miles an hour, and it looked, things looked rosy. But unfortunately, Mitchell and his zeal overstepped the bounds of knowledge, and during flying trials in America, wing flutter, or aileron reversal, hasn't been established which it was, occurred, and the pilot partially lost control and the machine fell into shallow water and was completely wrecked. I think that's a picture just taken just prior to the takeoff. So, of course, the S4 was never able to show its paces. Although the estimated speed was 237 miles an hour, and in the consequent contest, the Americans averaged 232, so it's doubtful whether the S4 would have won it. But nevertheless, it was a very bold attempt. The Italians, they'd produced a new design, a monoplane flying boat. Now, no slide of this, but you've probably seen it in various books. It was a very sleek arrangement, a monoplane cantilever flying boat with a D12 engine mounted in a streamlined nacelle, supported by backward staggered struts, a rather unusual arrangement, and in the event it did not prove very efficient, although the pilot actually mistook the turning point, and he averaged an extra 4 miles per lap. So that his average speed, was nowhere near representative of the actual capabilities of the machine. Oh yes, I was of course talking about the Americans. Now the Americans, in spite of no international competition, had arranged with between the United States Navy Air Service and the United States Army Air Force a series of contests in the Pulitzer Trophy. And this had brought the CR3 development to a greater state than even the Europeans expected. Can I have the next slide, please? Now, if you compare that with the CR3, you'll see where they've improved it. The single interplane strut dropped the top plane right onto the top of the fuselage. The chassis struts have been brought into a very sharp V, and you can see how small the machine is, of course, with too little standing on the plate. The wing radiator, of course, is self-evident. This towel scheme, they were quickly convertible to two land planes, as I said. But, I think in this particular contest, the Pulitzer Trophy race was held practically the same week as the Schneider Trophy. You see, they took the land chassis up and replaced it with a seaplane. It did have a new engine, this machine, compared with the CR3. It was still a Curtiss development of the D12, and the horsepower had gone up to 600. As I said before, there was a new aspect appeared in this particular contest, and that was service rivalry. United States Navy versus the United States Army. On this occasion, the United States Army demanded to be represented, and they chose Lieutenant Doolittle as their champion. And in the contest, he showed in no uncertain manner that anything the United States Navy could do, the United States Army could do better. He averaged 232 miles an hour for the course, and the second place was taken by Hubert Broad on the Gloucester 3, who averaged only 199 miles an hour. A bit disappointing, but there it was. The Italian, as I mentioned before, mistook the turning point, and he only averaged 168 miles an hour. I should mention that this flying of Doolittles, of course, was the outstanding feature of this race. A few days after the completion of the contest, he established a new world seaplane record in it at 245 miles an hour, and his average speed was 232. So that he only lost 13 miles an hour over 10 laps, 7 laps, of 3 turns per lap. So you can see that he must have been going full bore practically all of the way. The 1926, the ninth contest, was held at Newport in the USA. And of course it was of special interest because it was decided if the United States would win the trophy outright. Unfortunately, the British government declined to finance an entry, and it was left to the Italians to be the sole challengers, and they carried off a surprising victory in the following circumstances. The Curtiss CR3, that machine there, was just about at the end of its aerodynamic development. As you can see, you couldn't do much more in the way of refinement, and the only opportunity was to increase the horsepower of the engine. And this was done, two of the machines were fitted with a new Packard engine and one with a new Curtiss, and they were rated at 700 horsepower. And the third entry was simply that particular machine was just dusted off and tanked up for the train. But just how important this aerodynamic development was will be shown by the Italian entry. Castoldi was very impressed with the S4, and of course the fact that it had this wing flutter made him think, and he solved it in a very simple way. He propped the wing to the bottom of the fuselage and wire braced it in the same way as the old pre-war machines. Next slide, please.
Well, that more or less answers the whole story. You can see the wing radiators at the root. The machine, the fuselage was very much on the Curtis lines in cross-section. There is another picture, David, please. That's the side elevation, and of course, this symmetrical, I say symmetrical tower, it isn't quite, but we do. This feature Castaldi retained on all his racing aeroplanes. And to the surprise of the Americans, this machine averaged 246 miles an hour in the course, whereas the two United States aircraft with the new engine both retired with mechanical trouble, and their only other contestant finish was last year's winner, which averaged 1 mile an hour less than the previous years. So it put the Italians really well on the top. The British government did not compete that year, as I will describe later on. The most interesting thing that came out of this 1926 contest was the deflation of American interest. After their defeat, the United States government said they would sponsor no further entries, and it was left to private enterprise to put the Americans into the contest, and it met with the same result as the Europeans did. It put the Americans right out of the contest. Before leaving the American scene, I should say that the Americans were very efficient in their organization of the contest and their publicity. And I think this was brought back across the Atlantic, and no doubt accounts for the enormous popularity that was taken up by in Europe immediately afterwards. And by now, of course, the contest had become of full international importance. And to introduce you to the 10th contest, a slightly wider viewpoint is necessary. At that time, the Italian dictator Mussolini had been provoking the British government in various ways, among them the alleged superiority of the Italian Air Force over the British. And you can imagine how delighted the Italians were with their victory. Now, whether this goaded them into action or not, I don't know, but on this particular occasion, the British government went mad. They ordered 7 aircraft. 3 clusters and 2 supermarines, and there was a third type, the Short Crusader. Rather, it's called the Short Crusader. I believe it was entered by Colonel Bristow and was designed by W.G. Carter. But it was a very interesting try, but I'll tell you more about that. The argument of the monoplane versus the biplane was still unsettled. And this seemed to be a good opportunity to settle the matter once and for all. Both designers were leading exponents of the type, and they were both supplied with the same engine. So, could I have the next slide, please? And this is Holland's, well, it was his last biplane, the Gloucester 4. Very nice machine, elegant lines. One of the things I always think about the Gloucester 4 is that it never photographed well. I think this was due to the colour scheme. That fuselage was a very light blue and the wings were all gold. It never seemed to do full justice to the machine, but those wings from the front view gave the appearance of growing out of the fuselage and the cylinder blocks. And as I said, it was the last biplane to appear in the contest, and it was a very elegant machine to play that way. It was slightly slower than the S5, but to criticise the detailed design of one at the expense of the other, I think, is of no importance. So this is the S5, and this is Argentus in the foreground. Now, this was the machine that really Mitchell really went to town on. His S4 was bold in overall concept, but the S5, he really got down to detailed design, and he made really a world beater. Napier people collaborated very closely with him, well, and of course, Holland. They tidied the line up in a considerable manner. Mitchell collaborated by introducing the first all-metal fuselage, which was a very narrow cross-section. Well, the area was reduced to 5.9 square feet. And when you see it, you wonder where the pilot got in there. He managed it. This flash radiators on the wing. Now, the Curtiss people had the fluted type. So did Holland on his four. And the Italians also the fluted type. Mitchell wouldn't have those. He said they increased the drag too much. And he built his own, which were made of 24 gauge copper plate, 28 gauge copper plate, with an 06 gap between corrugated channels, and they were sweated together, and then screwed down to a three-ply wing. But the greatest innovation was in the floats. In the 1925 contest, Mitchell noticed the Americans had used two small tanks in each float to supplement their fuel. He thought about this, and he argued that if all the fuel was placed in one float and opposed to the port of the engine, it would be doing useful work, and it would also lower the CG of the seaplane itself. And this was done, and there was no getting away from it, but it was really an outstanding feature of the machine. The float struts and the thing were all reduced. The reserve buoyancy was reduced to floats, and the general efficiency improved all the way around, so that all these developments, plus the increase in horsepower, resulted in the S5 being 84 miles an hour faster than the S4. It's quite a big jump. Now, there is another slide, the third type, Crusader. Again, of all wooden construction except for the float, and of course this was the first Bristol Mercury engine to be installed. But the unfortunate thing with this machine was that when it went to Italy, the aileron wires were coupled the wrong way round, and of course the disastrous results of takeoff. But fortunately, without injury to the pilot. And the Italians, or I should say the Americans first, had entered for the 1927 contest. The Packard Company developed a 24-cylinder engine for use on their airships. And one of these was borrowed and installed in an airframe, which was really a CR-3 scaled up. But it never performed very well and never appeared as a starter. The Italians, as defenders, they changed their machine very little. All they did was to increase the horsepower rather than improve any aerodynamic or introduce any aerodynamic advantages. I think there is a slide of that. Can I have the next one? No, it isn't. All right. So that it was left to a duel between Great Britain and the Italians. The Great Britain's final three entries were two Supermarine S5s and one Gloucester 4. The S5s were piloted by Flying Officer Webster, the Gloucester 4B piloted by Flying Officer Kinghead, and the other S5 by Flying Officer Forsyth. There was just a slight variation. One S5 and the Gloucester 4 were fitted with a geared Napier Lion, which was marked the 7A, which was a geared engine, and that developed 860 horsepower, and the other was an ungeared, which developed 900 horsepower. The idea of gearing the engine, of course, was to get better efficiency from the propeller with a slower running engine. The Italians had introduced a new design called the Marchi 67. As I said, the only feature about this was an increase in horsepower. It was reputed to develop 1,000 horsepower, but I don't think that it did. The six competitors started at minute intervals, 5 minute intervals, sorry. Kinkead being the first away, followed by an Italian, then a Supermarine S5, an Italian, and a Supermarine S5, and finally an Italian. The early part of the race promised to be very exciting, but in the second lap, one of the Italians retired. Gradually they all fell away until the sixth lap, when Kinkead had to retire with a damaged spinner, which set up engine vibration. So it left the two Supermarine S5s to finish the course. And the winner was Flight Lieutenant Webster, who averaged 281 miles an hour. The Worsley second at 273. This victory, of course, overwhelmed the Italians and undoubtedly put Britain on the top. The best, the two slow machines, the direct drive and the Gloucester 4, both averaged 7 miles an hour faster than the best Italian lap speed. So there was no doubt about it that the S5s were faster than the Italians, even accounting for the engine failures. Well, this put Great Britain back onto the aeronautical map in no uncertain fashion, and frightened the Italians considerably. But if the British government had gone mad the previous year, they soon returned to sanity under the straitjacket of economy. The contest was no sooner over than they announced that the cost of the contest was excessive and they were not prepared to finance another if held annually. The Royal Aero Club, however, had other ideas, and after pressing the government relentlessly, they stretched the promise that if the cost could be spread over 2 years, the government would enter the contest in 1929. Meanwhile, other countries felt the need for more time to develop their aircraft engine, and they approached the Federation Aeronautique International, asking for a yearly gap between the contests. So this is where Britain performed a very smart piece of work. They wrote to the Federation and said that although as winners they were in a very dominant position, they would not vote against the proposal of the race being held every other year if it was the wish of the other contestants. Well, of course, they thought the other contestants thought that Britain was doing the very gentlemanly thing, and they proposed that the race be held every other year, and a tentative date for 1929 was fixed. It was known that France, Italy, and America were all making strenuous efforts to recapture the trophy, and big improvements had to be made if the aircraft Britain was to retain the trophy. And the Napier Lion now appeared to be just about at the end of its development life, and R.J. Mitchell saw of this, and when they offered him 1,230 horsepower with a 300-pound increase in weight for the Lion, he turned it down. No, it's not sufficient. And he looked elsewhere for an engine, and he went to Rolls. And who eventually, after some deliberation, they weren't at all keen, they guaranteed him an engine of 1,500 horsepower. And with this as a basis, he started designing his next machine, the S6. The Rolls engine, of course, was much bigger than the Lion, and consequently the S6 itself was larger than the S5. The all-up weight being 5,771 of the S6 as against 3,250 of the S5. But on the S6, which was an all-metal machine, the first and only all-metal machine in the contest, There was some great ingenuity entered into the machine and made a remarkable impact on the aircraft industry. But this is a picture taken during the contest, and it shows Kincaid in the Gloucester 4 overtaking Worsley in the Beard S5 on the beach in the lake. But it's just, I'm afraid it really crept into that state. It's only just a picture on the very bad end of that. So this is the S6. This was probably, well, undoubtedly, Mitchell's greatest effort in target closing, full of innovations. It had to be to accommodate this powerful engine. The wing radiator was outstanding in their simplicity and effectiveness. All it consisted of was two thicknesses of 28 gauge dura sheet with a 16 thick spacer washer between, and alternately, these spacers took the screws that held them onto the rib flange. So that this radiator did the performed a triple duty of a smooth wing contour, the radiator, and a stressed wing as well. It's a wonderful piece of economical engineering. The floats in the tanks were still retained, and the cooling was done on the side of the fuselage, then into the fin, which also served as an oil tank, then ran along the bottom of the fuselage back to the engine. Could I have the next slide, please? This was Collins Gloucester 6, and he retained the Napier Lion engine, now Mark 7D, and a lot of hard work into it, but without doubt, the Gloucester, the Napier 7D, was overboosted, and it was never a good engine. Just prior to the contest itself, they had the withdrawal machine, and the old S5 stood in as number 3 for the British team. Slide the next slide. So this was the American effort. They still kept this 24-cylinder engine they developed for the airship, and that was it was a biplane in the previous year, so they pulled the top wing off and put a new nameplate. It was called Mercury, but whether they named it after the messenger of the god or element, I'm not sure, but it looks very heavy to me. It never appeared in Stephen North. The Italians, in their 1927 defeat, they sort of rushed about, and General Belbo, the Italian Air Minister, issued an open invitation to all airframe and engine manufacturers to collaborate with an idea of producing a winner. And unfortunately, too much time was spent in the preliminary stages, and they never appeared on the starting line. But there was one machine that was very interesting, completely unorthodox, and that was the Piaggio B7. Could I have the slide? This machine was rather novel in as much that they proposed to do away with the static pressure lift of floats and substitute hydrofoils for takeoff. This is a photograph of the model. It's balanced on the and the proposal was, and at the back is a marine propeller. The fuselage itself providing the flotation when the machine was at rest. The principle was to take off to engage the marine propeller, which moved the machine forward, and then lifted it on the hydrovanes. So until the air screw was clear of the water, then that was started, and took over the remainder of the takeoff, and the machine was supposed to be airborne. The estimated top speed was 360 miles an hour. I've never seen any photographs of it in the air, but I've certainly got one of it afloat, so could I have the next one? And there's proof that at least it would float, that it wouldn't fly. But it was a very courageous experiment, and what I thought was interesting was that after the war, with the advent of the jet engine, if you remember the Convair Sea Dart, they used hydravanes for the jet engine. Of course, it was quite successful. The only thing being that they were flat water machines. I mean, I couldn't imagine that taking off in the Solent. It was all wooden construction, I'm trying to say. Well, as I say, this machine never appeared in Great Britain. It was only an experimental machine. The Italian entry of Challenger for 1929 being the M67. Again, the old layout, symmetrical tail. The only outstanding feature was the engine, which was a Isotta Fascini of 1,500 horsepower. This was 18 cylinders, from three banks of six. That previous slide showed the machine of the Kelsha. Again, it was, it obviously lacked development because, after some flying experience, it did 347 miles an hour top speed as against the S6 357. That's it. So there were only 10 miles an hour difference in the two machines. It shows how closely the Solvay and Mitchell were and how meticulous you had to be in detailed design to obtain just those miles an hour difference. It's a very small machine. But the race followed the pattern of the 1927 event. Two Italian machines, those fitted with the new engines, I just mentioned, had to retire. And the only interesting thing was the duel for second place between Del Molin, the Italian, and the R.C. Gray, including S5, and Del Molin in the M52, the last year's machine. And on this occasion, the Italian won by 18 seconds. Just reverse the tape. The winning effort was by Flight Lieutenant Waghorn, who flew the S6 at an average speed 328 miles an hour. The other S6, flown by Flight Lieutenant Hattie, was disqualified from flying inside of one of the pylons. But he had the satisfaction of breaking the 50 and 100 kilometer world record. I didn't, of course, mention the Rolls-Royce engine, which was the most, star part of the S6. As I mentioned earlier on, that Rolls-Royce guaranteed Mitchell 1,500 horsepower, but at the time of the race, it developed 1,900. And although this bonus of 400 horsepower was welcomed by Mitchell, it brought its own problems. The main one, of course, being the terrific torque set up by the propeller, which made the, tended to dig the wing into the water. It was very serious. And, they had to, take fuel from the port to the starboard float to counteract it. The other point, of course, was the additional cooling. Again, there was insufficient area on the wings, so they had to introduce fairly large pads on the front of the float to accommodate extra cooling surface. But it was a perfectly practical machine, and this was demonstrated, especially from the Rolls-Royce point of view, by the incident that occurred on the night before the contest, when evidence of piston failure was discovered through one of the plug holes. And its solution meant they had to remove the cylinder block and replace it. Fortunately, there were a number of Rolls engineers staying at Southampton, and they were dragged from their beds, and proceeded with a wheel, took the cylinder block off and replaced it. And by dawn, it was all back, and the first engine run was completed. And later in the day, that machine won the contest itself. The only other anxiety was one that Waghorn produced by attempting an additional lap. And this was due to failure of his lap indicator. When I say lap indicator, you probably think of a dial with a needle. But it was nothing of the sort. It was a piece of pre-ply, made 4x6, and had 7 holes punched in it, and over the holes was a piece of paper, and it was the pilot's duty to poke his finger through the hole in the paper as he completed each lap. And of course he'd forgotten to do it, but he got down quite safely, and he proved the winner. Well, the spray had hardly settled from the contest when the government flatly announced that they would have nothing more to do with the contest. The cost was far too high, and the country could not afford it. You've heard these words before. It was estimated it would cost £80,000, a sum they did not feel justified in spending, with the country facing severe industrial depression. However, as the closing date for entries drew nearer, a patriotic gesture on the part of Lady Houston, the widow of a shipping banker, who guaranteed £100,000 from a private fortune, enabled Britain to enter a team for 1931. In the usual British way, of course, this Lady Houston, I suppose, is unknown to quite a number of people, and he remains, as I say, just a shadowy figure. But her action, no doubt, was responsible for us winning the Battle of Britain. Oh, I've got two more slides. Could I have another slide, please? Oh, yes. By the time that this fumble over the entry was cleared up and we were able to go ahead, time was very short. It was in February of 1931, and the contest was to be held in September. So any attempt to rebuild or design and build a new machine is completely out of question. And Mitchell was faced with the problem that all the designers had been faced, that is, defending with an old airplane and an old engine. So it was decided to use the two S6s in a slightly modified form, and they were called the S6A, and two new machines would be built. They would be called S6B. And Rolls, of course, would develop the engine. And that is a picture of the S6B being built. Again, no innovations this time. It was just a matter of obtaining more efficiency, except for the cooling. With the increase in horsepower of the Rolls engine, which went up by 450, it meant that greater area was required for cooling. And on this occasion, Mitchell used the top of the float as a radiator surface. Hold the top. The oil coolers themselves, the efficiency had to be increased, and this was done by fixing small battle plates in these corrugated, which had the effect of forcing the oil to the outside of the coolers and providing more efficient cooling. And actually, it worked very well. There was a temperature difference of 60 degrees centigrade between the outlet and inlet temperature. Is there another slide, please? There it is, completed. And you can see the sort of film of the radiator in the float construction. And if you've seen the machine at, say, Kensington, you'll think, well, it looks pretty rough, and I suppose it was, but in those days, they couldn't sort of get quite the finish and efficiency of the smooth surfaces that we can get today. the machine was clean as a whole, but the execution of some of the joints and whatnot were a bit rough, I must admit. And to overcome this, on the rudder and the elevators, they introduced a small trim tab. It consisted of a piece of plate about 6 inches long, just riveted to the training wheels, and this was bent up to suit the individual pilot who liked it on the machine. This just relieved the loads off the pilot, and they were quite the same machines to fly hands off when you're in the air. Big difficulty was the takeoff, and this was due to this gigantic torque setup. The air screw itself, of course, the blades being practically stalled just prior to takeoff. When you see the film, you'll see that the machine takes off almost stalled, but directly the air screw gets a grip on the air, and when it goes, it goes like a bullet. Could I have the next slide? This is the R engine. It's at the time of the 1931 contest developed 2,350 horsepower, and well, it was the most powerful engine in the world at the time. Now, Castoldi was responsible for the 1931 Italian Challenger, but unfortunately the machine was never finished in time to come over. But he persevered with it, and as I said at the beginning of the lecture, I think he attained the ultimate in the propeller-driven seaplane. In his pursuit of horsepower, he never had any Rolls-Royce firms to that. And his particular sort of, at least it wasn't his, that the designer of the Fiat concern, Monsieur Signor Zerbi, offered this. It's two 12-cylinder engines back-to-back. And there were two separate units in the gears, and they drove two shafts, one inside the other, and this was the first practical contra-rotating airscrew in the world. Castoldi realized, well, before Mitchell, I think, that the port of the propeller was the thing that had to be overcome. The S6 would just about fly, and I mean, another 100 horsepower, and I don't think they would have got it off the water. Just for field. As Mitchell said when he summed up the 1929 contest, the requirements for racing aircraft are very exacting. You just fulfill the requirements and no more. And this is what he managed to do with the S6. Say, Castoldi realized that this wasn't the right answer. He had to have contra-rotating airspeed, and this was the result. Could I have the next slide, please? And that shows his proposed Challenger. That's the M72. Now, with that engine, as you can imagine, of course, the radiator problem was enormous. That and the oil. There was an oil cooler there. The whole of the wing was radiator. The rear part of the fuselage was radiator. The top of the floats, the struts, the radiator. But he persevered with the design and eventually finished with the world speed record for aircraft at 440 miles an hour, a speed that stood until 1939 when it was beaten by the German Wendel, who was flying a Messerschmitt 109R. The most disappointing thing about the 1931 contest, of course, was the absence of challengers. After all the magnificent gesture of Lady Houston and the hard work put in by Supermarine Rolls-Royce and the pilots of the high-speed flight, it came as an anticlimax when it was learned that the French and Italians had withdrawn their machine ready. The Fédération Aéronautique Internationale were quite convinced that to pull the race off was the wrong thing, and they told Britain to prepare as for an actual contest. So the British team comprised of Flight Lieutenant Bootman, Flight Lieutenant Long, and Flight Officer Snake. Bootman was the mainstay, the others being in reserve in the event. Department's order was to complete the course, to beat the records, and if possible, beat the 100-kilometer record. But he did all three, and for the race average, 340 miles an hour. So with that flight, and at that speed, the last chapter of the Snyder Trophy came to an end. But as it did, another chapter opened for the Rolls-Royce engineers, our engine, carried on and little proposed new design, an airframe carrier, and of course this combination was known as the Spitfire, played a decisive part in the Battle of Britain during the war. And in the hands, of course, of the Royal Air Force pilots, who had done so much to win the entire program. So to sum up the lessons of the series, the following part had emerged. The development of high-speed seaplanes during the period series was possible only by using nature's longest runway, sea. And arising out of this, that if the aeroplane was to develop along the same lines, the following experiences were necessary. Non-concrete runways, adoption of the monoplane layout, variable pitch propellers, retractable undercarriages, flaps, and wheel brakes. And by 1939, in fact, all of these weren't standard, they were going into practically all types of design. The chemical fuel approach of the Rolls-Royce engine was more economical and a better bet than just increasing the cubic capacity. So although the Snyder Trophy did not develop as the originator intended, it more than justified his hopes and aspirations, secured for Monsieur Snyder an imperishable name in aviation, and really as a piece of artwork has had a profound effect on technical progress, or inspired so many to foster the spirit of international friendship. And finally, I think I should pay tribute to a very gallant band, those men, I can only call men with iron guts, the pilots who flew all these machines.